So what I should have been incredibly proud of, I was completely ashamed of.
Hi, welcome back to Let Me Ask You Something, the weekly podcast where I, MD Pittman, talk to everyday ordinary people about something extraordinary in their lives. Now this week I talked to Simon Rumney. He is a person who did not learn until later in life that he had a learning disability. He was called stupid and lazy for his inability to read. Those are his words, not mine. But he's adapted to that, and he's learned to read, and he's written a few books. So without further ado, here is my interview with Simon Rumney.
All right, so we are live. Welcome back to week four of season two of, this will be week five of season two of the Let Me Ask You Something podcast. And today we are talking with Simon Rumney, chronic dyslexic, going from a chronic dyslexic to a five-star author in one screwed up lifetime. So let me ask you something, Simon. How screwed up is your lifetime?
Wow, where to start? I think it's always best to start right and set a scene. So, if I may, so I was born 10 years after the Second World War. So the year rationing stopped in England. My parents were both teenagers when Germany bombed London. So to put that in perspective, you know what 9/11 did to the psychology of America. It was horrific. Yep. Everybody was in shock. They did it for 57 nights on the trot. 45,000 people were killed by bombing. So you can imagine the trauma that they experienced.
Yeah.
Then my father became a man, as it were, at 18, joined the army and went in through D-Day. And so that's the sort of the background. So my parents were in terrible shock, as was the country. I didn't understand this. Only now do I understand this. So I was born into a sort of a post-traumatic stress life. And that really defined me, it defined the country, it defined my parents and the characters. That was there's the foundation, if you will, of my birth.
Okay. So how do you take that to being a five-star author? I mean, what happened? Where was that from? Talk
about
being a five-star author.
Oh, I started writing as therapy effectively, yeah. But I should really go right back to that early stage and say why I needed therapy and what happened in my journey. So, to give you an example, I'm going to ramble here. Just jump in and
you're fine.
Change my direction.
We all ramble.
So just jump in and change the direction when you need to. But before I was born, I let my mother down. I was in her womb. She was in a cinema in England watching a movie called Doctor at Sea with Dirk Bogarde. She decided that I was going to be a doctor. She named me Simon after the new character. And then I had learning disabilities. So for her, I was a complete failure from the get-go. I did not live up to what she had set as my journey. So I had terrible mental problems because I'd let her down. I went to school and I couldn't read and write and I couldn't do math and I couldn't do any of that stuff. And the teachers, in those days, it was a country town. They'd moved out of London. They were in the countryside. And the teachers didn't understand dyslexia. So they called me lazy and stupid, which I believed. Then I left school at 15 to wander. My parents were quite clever. They put me in a catering college to become a chef because they knew that chefs could make money without reading and writing. So I did that. Didn't suit me. And so then I wandered to, I was a farmhand, I was a laborer, I was an airport baggage loader, anything that didn't require reading and writing, I did. And then I wandered, I drifted through that existence, always feeling insecure, always waiting for somebody to catch me because I knew I was lazy and stupid. And then I drifted into sales and I joined Rank Xerox, which is your Xerox. In England, it's called Rank Xerox. And they trained me how to be a salesman and I took off from there so I could talk. And as a salesman, I didn't have to write anything because, you know, the secretaries could do that. And then, so I was reasonably successful. And then I got promoted up the chain, you know. And then eventually I drifted into computers, communications computers. And then I, again, did well there. And eventually became CEO of computer companies. Small startups, but significant in terms of money. Usually Silicon Valley startups, and I would started in the UK, then I moved to Australia, and I set up their operations in the Asia Pacific. So I always did very well financially, but I always knew in the back of my mind I was lazy and stupid, and I didn't deserve to be there. So I sabotaged myself. So every time I had great success, I would drink too much, I would have bad relationships, I would, you know, do all the wrong things, and then I would leave. At the peak of success, nobody could understand what the hell was happening. But so I was going through this roller coaster of depression and sadness because I really didn't believe I was worthy. I felt like a fugitive, you know, always looking over my shoulder because somebody's going to walk through that door in a minute and say, get out of here. You shouldn't be in that at that desk sort of thing. So that was hellish. For a long time, and my relationships were defined by the personality that was formed by my parents. So I had a lot of failed relationships. The money I made was like throwing petrol on a fire. It just allowed me to be more dysfunctional. And I was ashamed of everything. I used to, I couldn't read the white papers that, you know, because these were quite technologically advanced products. So now every kid knows what bridging and routing is and local area networking, but in those days nobody did.
Yeah.
But I couldn't read the white paper. So what I used to do is I'd get my techos or my marketing guys in. I'd buy a couple of beers and say, look, I know what's going on. I've read it, but you show me what you think of it. So basically bullshit. So they would write it on a whiteboard and I'd say, well, what does that do? How does that beat the competition? Why is that good? And as soon as they told me, bang, it was in my head, I could sell it.
Yeah.
And then to simplify things for me, I used to get the marketing people to draw it in. I used to say to them, look, I understand it, of course, but draw it like a kid would understand it. So they would, and then I would understand it. and then as those drawings became more and more prevalent, they actually turned them into sales manuals, and it helped the sales force sell them to customers. So, okay. So what I should have been incredibly proud of, I was completely ashamed of. I felt that that was a weakness. Instead, looking back, it was a tremendous, it was very clever. I was very clever, but I never really understood it. And then, kind of the next stage to answer your question, how did I become a five-star author?
Yeah.
Was at the end of that period when I broke down.
How did you break down? What happened?
Okay, I'd take a breather there because I'd rambled right through the whole thing and didn't.
No, you're fine.
Question. Okay, so I was depressed, clearly depressed. I was very dysfunctional in my relationships. I couldn't maintain them.
Yeah,
it was awful. And I had a relationship with somebody who I loved, and when that ended, I was. It just pulled the rug under me. I was suicidal. Yeah. I was a mess.
Spiral downward. Yeah.
Exactly. It was, you know, it was unnecessarily sad, really. But I didn't know it was unnecessary. I thought that was my reality. That thing. So I went to the shrink and I kind of sought help. And one day during one of the sessions, you know, I saw him for 3 years, but I guess it was sort of a year in. I had to write a letter, and at the time I didn't have a secretary I could dictate to or So I had to write it myself because it was an important letter. And so I wrote it. He read it. He always said, oh, you're dyslexic. I said, no, I'm not. He said, why do you say you're not dyslexic? I said, every time I've asked anybody, the teachers or my friends or people at work, they say, no, dyslexic's writing backwards. And he said, no, this is dyslexia. So I just wept for an hour.
Because you find out why you're not stupid and dumb.
I saw a crack of light in a door that was like released. Oh my God, I'm not, maybe it, I didn't at that moment think, oh, I'm not stupid, I'm cured. But I saw there was something that hadn't been there before. It was always, you know, hold on, maybe there's an answer here. So I went home that day and I had a garage full of computers that were still in boxes, because every time I worked for a computer company, they'd give me a laptop. Not in those days, they weren't laptops, but they gave me a PC. Yeah. So they're all in boxes. So I went to the garage and grabbed one and plugged it in and made it work and then started writing. And it just fell out of me. The whole thing just fell out of me. I couldn't spell. I couldn't punctuate. I had no idea what prose were. But the raw story fell out. And it was a really good story. I love history. So it was set in ancient Rome. And it just turned into a book, and then that book, and there was another book, and there's loads and loads of books, and there's screenplays and short stories. And it turns out that ironically is how I communicate, by writing, and I never had, for fear of showing people how stupid I was.
Now Shrink said that you had dyslexia and that your teachers thought it was something different. What did he see, or what were you doing to indicate dyslexia?
Simply misspelling words.
Really?
Just, that's what dyslexia is. It's misspelling words. It's dyslexia takes many, many forms. Yeah. I have a Facebook page called Dyslexics Unanimous. And every kind of way that you can't read, you can't write, you can't spell, you can't punctuate, you can't whatever, if there is a problem, if a kid has a problem with any aspect of writing and reading, that's dyslexia, basically. But everybody will tell you, no, that's not true. Dyslexia is writing backwards, or, you know, there is a stereotype that really caused me terrible problems as a kid, and it's still causing kids problems now.
Yeah, wow. So, talk about your, as you put it in an email to me, your kooky way of marketing complex technology. You talked a little bit about it already, but can you expand on that?
When I first started selling, it was copiers, and Xerox in England have this great college in Newport Pagnell, where they actually, everybody that joins Xerox goes to this. It's a proper training facility, a proper campus college. You stay there for whatever the term of your training is. You know, engineers go there, marketing, sales. So they taught me how to sell, and I could sell a copier because there was no technology involved in a copier. There is, but you didn't need to know it. You just needed to
know. You needed to work.
people needed copies, and I could sell them something to make copies. So that was easy for me to do. But as I moved up the tree in terms of computers, it became more and more and more complex. And whereas the copier was already established, it was old technology, everything I was involved in was brand new. So to give you an example, I came to Australia, and I was invited to come to Australia by a company. And they had to advertise the position that they wanted me to come and do in every newspaper in Australia, every state in Australia, to prove that an Australian couldn't do the job that I would be emigrating to do. That was the law, and it makes sense. And they couldn't find anybody that knew what I knew. And my skill, believe it or not, think of it now, how ridiculous it is. My skill was knowing what a local area network was. You know, so like there isn't a house in the States or here or in anywhere in the world, probably, yeah. anywhere in the first world, sorry, that wouldn't have a Wi-Fi network now. And in those days, I was kind of the only person that understood what that was. So I was always on the leading edge of technology. So there was no, there was never a precedent of what this was, how to sell it. And I couldn't read the paper, the white paper, which were always technical based. Yeah. They were never sales based. So I had to work out those techniques with whoever I could find, you know, and I was ashamed of it, but I realize now how clever it was.
So how different would your life have been if you were properly diagnosed as a child?
Well, yes. The irony is, now, see, there is another layer to this. Because my mother is sadly, my mother is a sociopath. So she couldn't love. She had no empathy. Mm-hmm. And my father was PTSD because of D-Day and the Blitz.
Yeah.
So he couldn't love. So I got no love as a cliche, I know, but no love as a child. So had I have been successful at school, I would have gone on to become an arrogant bully, probably. You know, I probably would have become a grammar Nazi, people I hate, and I probably would, you know, I probably would have been successful but quite aggressive because I did not have love. So I was I'm what they call an empath. So I've been doing a lot of work in the last few years because as an empath, I've been ensnared by narcissists my whole life. So to answer your question, had I have not had learning disabilities,
You were properly diagnosed.
Or I was properly diagnosed.
Yeah.
I probably would have had more confidence, but I would still be ensnared by narcissism. And because of the lack of love, I wouldn't have been a stable person. Recently, because for years and years and years, I saw shrinks. After that initial breakdown, I went to see shrinks. I took antidepressants. And no shrink diagnosed what my real problem was. I was always unhappy. I was always sad, and I thought it was depression. What I have done recently is there's an interesting guy called H.G. Tudor, and he's a psychopathic narcissist, but he writes these amazing books, and his insight into narcissism and the opposite, empathy. So narcissists need empathy, empaths. So yeah. Narcissists feed on empaths. So imagine Megan is the narcissist, Harry is the empath. What she's doing to him is what everybody I was in a relationship did to me. Slowly, slowly, slowly wearing them down, taking them away from their country, their home, their friends. They isolate them. So that would have happened to me. If I had been diagnosed, I probably would have been a more confident empath. And I probably would have gone into a career and made money and ensnared by a narcissist and had a miserable life. So there was no magic bullet. So, but now I understand that as an empath, I thought I had borderline personality. And this guy, H.G. Tudor, I've never spoken to him, but his teachings, that sounds like a guru or a cult, but his understanding is that there is no such thing as borderline personality. You're either suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. or you're a low-range narcissist. There's no border.
No middle ground. Okay.
No middle ground. And of course, and that just penny just dropped with me. The reason I'm sad is not because I'm depressed. It's because I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from a mother who was a total narcissist and used me and manipulated me to get her what she needed from life.
Yeah, because trauma really isn't, I mean, a lot of people see trauma, the PTSD, is kind of a newer term because of war, of battles,
yes,
and soldiers coming back home. That's where they see it. So when they think of somebody who may not have fought or served with PTSD, there's a lot of misconceptions about that, because it can be just as real, if not worse, because you're living it from an early age and have had it a longer time.
Bingo, you've hit the nail on the head. And you know, if you want to simulate war, try being born to a narcissistic psychopath. A mother who knows you intimately, yeah. you're sucking on her, you know, you're literally sucking on her. She watches your every emotion, every mood, every facial expression. She knows how to wind you up, for want of a better description, better than anybody in the world. And she does it because that's what she needs. She needs to get a response from others to validate who she is. That's what narcissists do. So she manipulated me. So my first memory is harming myself, and literally picking at my skin until I bled. So and then I had these terrible frustrations, and I was really angry all the time at the age of four. Now, the only way that could possibly happen is if my mother had caused it, because I lived in the country. I didn't know anybody else. So she was manipulating me. And my brother, to get what H.G. Tudor calls fuel. I won't labor that point. But so from the moment I was conceived, I was, to her, I was a failure, and she manipulated me. So it's only in the last couple of years that I've really got a handle on this.
Yeah.
And my personality has changed. Everybody's always seen me as a nice guy. I've always seen myself as not really worthy. And sometimes I would get, my behavior would be weird. I would lose my temper at the wrong places and strange behavior. And it was all because of this PTSD. And once I found that out, my personality has changed. I no longer need to be right in a conversation. That was a very boring part of my personality. So now I can listen to people and not need to correct them, just listen to the conversation. And now I'm seeing myself as others always saw me. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now I want to move on here to your writing. You have four books out. You said you have 15 screenplays.
sorry. I'll make myself clearer. I've written a ton of books.
Yeah.
But
four published.
Three published.
Three published.
Yeah, the I've written so much, but you see, a lot of it was rubbish because because I was so embarrassed at school, I didn't write. So yeah. I went into the lower streams, the dunces classes, and I didn't write, and I didn't read. So when I actually started writing, it was so naive and so raw. You know, and it filled the word. Sometimes, you know, the word couldn't work out what I was trying to say. It was spell check. but so the first few were really sort of my training wheels on my bike.
Yeah.
That's where I learned. I went back and edited the first one. Well, the first one I rewrote several times and had a professional editor edit it. And that's the rawest look into my brain. That the character in there, the protagonist in there, is me on a journey. And that's really me. For me, that's I think that's my achievement. But then once I'd written all these books, the first one was good enough, and then the latter ones got better because I taught myself prose.
Yeah, you have three books out right now. I guess Our Eternal Curse series. You have Another Self, Another War, and Another Tribe. Can you talk about that series there?
Yeah, it started with the first one is Another Self. So it's about my self-esteem, but it's I've written a character because I love history. I've written a character in Rome. It's a woman. I don't know why it felt easier to write a woman. And Julia, she has all of my, so you, when you read her, you're reading me, my journey. So she's, it's at the time for those historians before the end of the Republic and the beginning of the Empire. And she, I set her as the catalyst for the revolution that caused that change. So there's, you know, Caesar goes on to cross the Rubicon and all that. But she, I set her as the catalyst, and she starts off as a peasant, becomes incredibly wealthy, very rich, but never understands how clever she's being. So you can see the parallel there between myself and her. And that was about self-esteem. So that was another self. And then I thought, then I wanted to understand, because there are things in life that one can understand. There are things in the human condition that are hardwired. You know, our sexuality, our, you know, gender, all those things that you can't change. But the things you can change are self-esteem, your view towards racism, and your need to go to war. So I wrote, those were the driving force behind, sounds very grandiose, but those are the three things that interested me. So I set the same character, this Julia character. Mm-hmm. So she's in Rome. It's not really about reincarnation, but it's a notional idea of it. First one is set in Rome. The second one is she is a Kawasaki Indian. I think I'm saying that right. Who rescues a Confederate captain after the Battle of Shiloh, and then so you can imagine the juxtaposition there. So you've got an innocent Indian, and you've got a racist Southerner, and they fall in love, and then. They return
like
to Atlanta.
Romeo and Juliet type of thing.
It's exactly like star-crossed lovers. Yeah, yes. not as clever by any means, but I explored in that the ridiculousness of judging people on skin color.
Yeah,
I understand why it happens, because in human evolution, you know, tribalism was very important, because we had a water hole and you didn't, and then we went to war to fight that. So. They were the enemy and we are us, and we became a tribe. So I understand the basis of it, but now we're in a position where we can rationalize ourselves out of that by intellect. We can use our intellect to say that because you've got a different skin color, you're not threatening my water hole anymore. So it doesn't match, but it gets sadly entrenched, but it doesn't need to. Whereas, for instance, if you're gay or bisexual, whatever you are, you can't. That's genetic, and you can't do anything about that. But racism is thought. You can do something about that. So I use that story for my benefit, and everything I write is for my benefit, because I never believe that I'm good enough. You know, I when people give me 5-star ratings, I'm always so surprised. You know, I have other friends who are writers. They go to they go to book signings, and they. You know, they promote their work. I've never done that, because I've never had the confidence to believe that it could. Yeah. How could I possibly do anything good? Yeah. So, and then the third one is set in the First World War, same Julia character, set in the First World War, but on the from the German Austro-Hungarian perspective.
Okay.
She's the daughter of the chief of police of Sarajevo, where the whole thing kicked off, and then so. War could be stopped. It's within us. It's an instinct, but we can rationalize ourselves out of it if we want to. So those are the three things that are really interesting, but they're not about those subjects. The characters are not, you know, those are people experiencing real human experiences, but they're set within those drama points, as it were.
I was wanting to just ask you, what would you say to somebody now who, I guess, what advice would you give to somebody that, not necessarily your upbringing, but maybe your experiences with learning disabilities, who feels that they are stupid and dumb, or lazy and stupid, that feel this way, but they're really not?
I've set up a Facebook page because of my journey, my experience, but also I've got 5 god kids around the world, And as they were growing up, I made it my mission to be on top of where were they psychologically, where were they educationally. And one of them did have dyslexia, and I made sure that it was no big thing. And what the biggest problem, it seems, is that the kid doesn't know they should be ashamed until adults tell them to be. So the raison d'etre of my Facebook page is, it's more of a message to the teacher and to the parent, is because what happens is that most parents love their kids. I'm unique in that regard almost, but most parents love their kids and they want their kids to do well. So when they're told these days, because we've moved on a peg, when the teachers know they've got dyslexia now, so they'll say to the parent, your son has dyslexia, or your daughter has dyspraxia, your daughter, whatever. And the first reaction from parents is, oh my God, they're going to fail. And they might not say it, but their body language expresses it. So the kid sits there and goes, oh my God, what's wrong? That's my mother's fight or flight response. So something's wrong. And they're talking about me. And then it starts. And then the mother may never say anything but encouraging words, but the kid will always know that, hold on, there's something wrong here. And once you start building that foundation, you can't change it. Well, you can, but it's too late when you get to my age to do it.
Yeah.
So that's what I work on, is that parental, look, you know, Einstein was dyslexic. Branson is dyslexic. And there's lists and lists of, you know, actors and scientists and writers, and it's no big deal anymore. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And that's the message I get across.
All right, great. Anything else you'd like to say? We're kind of close to our time here, but any parting words or words of advice or words of wisdom you'd like to impart on the audience here?
Yeah, I would say to anybody that feels unhappy, really look into it. Don't let it fester like I did for a long time. Do the research. Look into narcissism. Look into your parents' behavior. Look into your relationships. But really look into yourself, and be ruthless, and don't hold back on the questions. And that's what I would say.
All right, great. Simon Rumney, thank you very much for being on my podcast. Let me ask you something. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, too.